You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our Sex Podcast Collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, we have talked a lot about ethical non-monogamy, polyamory, swinging, open marriage, open relationships. And because this is part of my community, I've read probably every book there is to read on the subject. Maybe there's a couple that have just come out that I haven't read, but you know, I've read all the non-monogamy books. And when this one came across my desk, it really is different. This is more of a kind of manifesto, a call to action, a philosophy. It's for the nerds in all of us. And you know, I use the word nerd lovingly, because I identify as a nerd and I love nerds. But it's like really gets into not the nitty gritty of daily life, but the real questions of why non-monogamy and what opportunities it holds. So I'm really excited to welcome the author. My guest today goes by two names, Simone and Simon. Van Zarlos is a writer and philosopher based in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. They published several books in Dutch, including a novel and a collection of columns. In The Trial of Geert Wilders, Van Zarlos shares a feminist and queer report of the trial against the Dutch right-wing politician. To learn a bit more about the book, you can check out an essay online. Now, the book that we're going to talk about today was recently translated into English and published by Publication Studio, and it's titled Playing Monogamy, where Van Zarlos critiques monogamous living and false notions of safety, proposing a non-monogamous love life and a different take on ownership and property. Their most recent book, Herdenken, Herdach, is a nonfiction work about queer forgetfulness, whiteness, and embodied commemoration. Van Zarlos curates collaborations between artists, activists, and scholars, and regularly appears on stage as a lecturer, interviewer, and performer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
How did I do with all that? God.
That was perfect, especially the in her denk and her dog. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're joining me from the Netherlands, so we're on an opposite time schedule here. But I want to start before we talk about the book and talk about your most recent project, because it is the response to the COVID-19 pandemic, which, of course, as I sit here in America, we are thinking about how it's impacting our country, but I want to remind people this is a worldwide pandemic, which is affecting, it's on every continent. So we know it is affecting so many more people outside of our little America bubble. So tell me about this project called Open Call.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the Open Call is called How Will We Remember the Corona Era, or the Monument the spread of a monument, I should say. And here again, you could also say the spread of a moment. And I'm basically asking people to send in their commemorations, their monuments, whatever they think of. If they think of themselves in the future, how would they be looking back? Like, what do they see, feel, touch, hear, taste? So this project basically comes from the trajectory of writing Herdenk and Herdacht, in, of course, coincidence with, as you were saying, the COVID-19 pandemic and what we're dealing with right now. So I've been thinking a lot about commemoration and memory and who holds memory, who holds space in authorizing our memory, who is telling histories, what are the forms of history that we privilege over others. So for example, oral history is seen as less important or less historic than written history. So we know all these things, but then the question comes, okay, what do we do with that? So in my art practice, I try to think about memory in different ways. And I thought to send out an open call, basically inviting people, anyone who speaks English or Dutch so far, maybe we'll translate, who knows, to send in a monument. And it can be any form of art, it can be any, can be a song, it can be a written text. And with the open call, I kind of want to counter the current present, or like how we are learning the current present. So for example, we're seeing graphs and charts divided by country, which I think is quite important to say. As you were saying, we're in an American or US American bubble, but it's also sort of how we are learning to understand this pandemic is through divisions by country or through nation states. So we're getting our numbers and you're getting your numbers in the US, and it's really sort of confined by the country that you're in. And there might be comparisons between the countries, but there's this sort of definite and self-explanatoriness to being inside a certain country, right? And I think the crossovers are very important, and also try to think beyond country borders. And then each day that we see these charts and we see these numbers, we see an increase or decrease of death rates and IC intakes. And I think like the way that we're looking at the current reality shows something about how we learn to categorize and value reality and daily life. But this way of understanding might not completely relate to how we are actually experiencing it. So this is a question that I continuously pose also in my most recent book, is this question of like, if we account for the fact that there's so many different ways of experiencing current reality, and that there's not some sort of overarching perspective that we can take and say like, oh, this person really experiences reality, because we know that we're living in actually different narratives, in different experiences, different access, different forms of accessibility, different privileges, I think is an important one to say. So what could history writing look like if we think from this abundance of difference? So the open call, the spread of a monument, also relates to, for example, the question of linear time. We tend to separate the past, the present, and the future. And then we think that we can only sort of progress towards the future, right? We're living in the present moment. We're living in this pandemic. But I found it really interesting that the pandemic kind of asked us to think and feel through time in a very active way, because you see a lot of people say like, oh, what if this is over, right? So we already start to imagine ourselves to the end of the pandemic, not even knowing, of course, what the end exactly means. Like, does it mean that there's a second wave? Does it mean a vaccine? Does it mean that the world has changed completely? Or does it mean that we go back to normal, which is quite a terrible status quo to go back to? So it's also like this question of like, how do we experience time? And I'm drawing a lot of inspiration from the Black Quantum Futurism Collective that are actually based in Philadelphia. And they propose, instead of a linear idea of time, they propose a circular idea of time, where thinking yourselves into the future also changes the present. So instead of waiting to progress into the future, we can already imagine ourselves into the future. We can already include futuristic thinking into the current moment. And then I think one last thing maybe to mention of the open call that I'm sharing internationally is that I'm not selecting any of the submissions. So all of these submissions are welcomed and they will all be performed and enacted. So I'm really I'm really interested in this idea of not selecting, especially because when I said earlier that we're really dealing with this question of like, how do we value things and how do we categorize? And as I'm looking from a philosophical perspective, when we say we drive towards an understanding of something, when we say we drive towards a valuation of something, we often see that we select and deselect. So selecting what is important, deselecting what is not important, selecting what belongs, deselecting what does not belong. So in the open call, I explicitly say there's no selection being made. And I will perform the monuments, all of the monuments. So if it will be many, many monuments, I don't know how, but we'll make sure to do it somehow, maybe in a collective. And in the performance, I will engage with surveillance cameras. And I will engage with the surveillance cameras because they're still working 24/7. They're still working 24/7. They're still on memorizing, I would say, the current moment. Even though if we look at public space, it has become less busy because of lockdown or quarantine. These cameras are still out there, and I have a lot of questions, and many people have a lot of questions, right, about surveillance in response to the pandemic. And I want to engage these surveillance cameras as full-on historians. So instead of seeing them as they are, cold sort of tools that are documenting, monitoring, surveilling the present, I want to propose to them, actually, you are a subject, you are, in my eyes, a person, a historian that I will approach. So I will approach the camera as a full subject. And this, in this way, it's kind of like a drag dance, so like drag king, drag queen, drag camera, where I want to invite them to drag up, if I can say it like that, or dance with me, where the camera is a drag historian, because I will approach it as a historian. And this way, I hope to take the camera, the surveillance tech camera that are out there everywhere, and also, of course, the surveillance apps or the apps that we want to use to I would say, combat, but maybe that's too much of a war word, but to combat the virus. And instead, by taking them so serious, I kind of want to engage the surveillance camera so people can submit their monument.
So this makes me think of a couple things. One is one of my mentors in life is a history professor. Her name is Claire Potter. She works at the New School. And she writes extensively about what she calls doing recent history. The notion that we do not have to wait decades or centuries to kind of look back on history and then be able to sort of frame it neatly, you know, right? You mentioned this, like frame it neatly, make it chronological, make it sort of make sense so that there's like a cohesive story that we can then write. And the notion that we can't make history or record history unless we're far away from it, right? Which totally falls in line with this. And also I think of the AIDS pandemic, which obviously there are moments here of overlap, and the notion of doing the history while it's in progress. Because I do think when we look back on things, there can be a fuzzy lens, there can be a nostalgia, there can be a way in which we make sense of something that actually in the moment didn't make sense. So writing it all down and expressing it now rather than later, a sort of an immediate history, feels so necessary to the times we're living in, and in fact, to things going on in our world right now, including in America, this uprising for racial justice and an end to police brutality. It seems urgent to record this history and not sort of wait for it to play, see how it looks on the other side and what we're gonna like write about in a textbook or something. And then it also occurred to me that, you know, we're sort of fully saturated with media coverage of the pandemic, and it can be a lot, you know, like at some point I feel like I have to like step back from the TV news coverage, the websites, the social media. But what has always struck me since the beginning is that the things that have really moved me and made me think and made me sort of stop in my tracks have been these personal stories. It's been when someone has posted on their Twitter or their Instagram, hey, this is how COVID-19 affected me. And they're all very individual. They're all very specific. And really these graphs and these charts and these statistics and these lines and these, it to me, it's so far distant from the people who are experiencing it, right? Like it's just so far away and it's so kind of matter of fact where they just write like 1,000 deaths today and it's just like a number and it's a phrase and it doesn't capture like the actual lived experiences of those folks who died and then all the people in their life who are left here and who maybe cared for them during the illness. So this also reminds me of a kind of a people's history, like a people's history of coronavirus, rather than a kind of top down, you know, the CDC will release a report and that will be all there is to know about how coronavirus went down.
Yeah, absolutely. So much in what you say. I think it's indeed like what you're saying, the people's history. And the realization of how history is shaped, of course, always by authority, how it's policed by authority, like what is out there, what becomes history, like what do we even remember when we do look back? And I think for me, it was really interesting to see at the beginning of what we experienced as COVID-19, and I'm saying we because of course there's many different geographical places where people started experiencing COVID way earlier than in the Netherlands or in the US. And it was immediately called a historical moment, which I think relates heavily on the fact that white collar workers were being asked to stay at home, right? Well, a lot of people working class were still going to their jobs or not able to stay at home. So the question is also this moment of like, it was so quick within the pandemic that people considered it a historic moment. And I wondered what authority is behind it or what sort of agency is behind this that we suddenly call it a historic moment. And I feel very inspired, for example, by Black feminists who are talking about, well, the end of the world was already here. The end of the world was already here when we couldn't have access to clean drinking water, for example. The end of the world was already here with colonial occupation. The end of the world is already happening in Gaza. So when does it become a historic moment? Is that with the occupation of Gaza, or is it now when certain people are affected by the pandemic? So I'm also really interested in this question, and I think it relates to what you're saying, and this idea of the people's history, is also like, when is history being used to put weight to something? And maybe from a different frame, I'm also reminded of, I was in Ferguson, St. Louis in 2015 when Black Lives Matter started, the protests started. Around the death of Michael Brown, or the murder on Michael Brown. And I remember so vividly also, like, in terms of you were saying about image saturation, images of the protest being out there and being immediately related to protests in the 60s. So using history as a force of power, right? Using history also to say, like, what is happening now is important. And this also leads to this question of, like, okay, who needs history, or who needs to pull up or push forward historic moments to say, like, the now is important? Because if the now, if your now, if your present is not important enough to be covered by national media, for example, then you need historic moments where your present was recognized, maybe even later only, not in the present moment, to give some weight to that moment. And I'm also thinking of what you're saying about individual stories. And I think this question is, like, when does the individual become collective, which is also through the body? So thinking of memory or history as something sensorial. What are the sensories when we think of the past? And especially because in Western tradition, there has been a separation between mind and body, where the body is chaotic and the body is finite, and the mind is rational, the mind is eternal. It can pass on, right? As long as we tell these stories, it passes on. Where commemoration becomes part of the category of the mind, and it doesn't enter into the body, because the body, again, is finite, it can get sick, it's chaotic. And I think we need to look at as your friend at the New School does, think of history more from this sensorial and embodied perspective. And this is also where the individual experience becomes collective, because the way that we experience our bodies, also in togetherness, but also alone, collective impression, or a public impression, or a political impression. And I would also like to say, in response to how you started, writing history now, I have to tell you, we're all, and it's also happening in every neighboring country that I know of. So the protests happening in the US are absolutely happening in Europe. There have been amazing numbers of protesters coming in different cities of the Netherlands. And you have to imagine the Netherlands is super small. You can drive through it in a few hours. So in different cities, people are coming, they're showing up, and they're showing up in solidarity with what is happening in the US, but also actively, vividly addressing the racism, the anti-Black racism that is happening in the Netherlands, in Europe. And the policing that is happening on different scales, because we might have a little bit less of a gun culture, not a little bit less, we have less of a gun culture. Police have similar structures, but not completely comparable, and we shouldn't compare things that, you know, that are different. But ethnic profiling, for example, is absolutely a problem. Problems with tax offices, etc. So all these things, I just wanted to say, like, if we're writing history now, it's good to feel that history is also not confined, right? Again, with these ideas of the ideas of borders, the ideas of that we speak different languages, which we do, but maybe if we think of the perspective of changing how we understand the world, which is for me what most of my work is about, like, how do we understand the world? What are the ways that our sight, our feel, our understanding is structured? Then I think that this idea of solidarity, or like the idea of protest, transgressing country borders is a very important one, especially because part of what we are protesting might be to abolish those kind of borders, might be to abolish the policing at the borders.
Okay, that's a lot to chew on. But it's interesting because I saw shades of your book playing monogamy. There's elements about being present and also elements of chaos and of the state and its sort of determination of what relationships get acknowledged. So let's take a commercial break. We're doing a special episode where we're only taking one commercial break. Here it is, people. Let's take a commercial break. And when we come back, I want to continue this discussion and bring in your book, Playing Monogamy. So stay with us. Hey, everyone, it's Tristan. So 2020 has been a lot, and we could all benefit from less stress and more sleep in our lives. It's so important to take care of ourselves and invest in our well-being during these times of anxiety. That's why I'm excited to partner with Calm, the app designed to help you ease stress and get you the best sleep of your life. If I don't get a good night's sleep, I'm kind of useless the next day. When I sleep well, I feel better in every part of my life. Calm has a whole library of programs designed for healthy sleep, like soundscapes, guided meditations, and over 100 sleep stories, narrated by soothing voices like Stephen Fry, Kelly Rowland, and Laura Dern. And I don't know if you've heard, but Harry Styles just did a sleep story that everyone is talking about. I don't know about you, but I've been leaning heavily on Calm more than ever right now. During the day, it could be something as simple as a 5-minute meditation, and at night, there are so many options to set me up for a good sleep. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's 40% off, unlimited access to Calm's entire library. Hundreds of hours of programming and new content is added every week. Get started today at calm.com/Tristan. That's calm.com/Tristan. Hi, all. It's pretty difficult to talk about things other than what's going on in our world right now. So delivering these ads to you are tricky for me, and I want to be transparent and honest about that. But also, these advertisers make it possible for us to do the show. And I believe in the ability of this show to help people. I don't consider pleasure something extra or frivolous or unnecessary right now. It is absolutely a part of resistance, justice, and freedom. One of our advertisers is Uber Lube. They make a great body-safe silicone lube with only two ingredients, silicone and vitamin E. No additives like parabens, preservatives, or petrochemicals. It's great for all kinds of sex play. Uber Lube adds a thin layer that leads to just the right amount of slip while still allowing for skin-on-skin sensations. If you need some lube, they're offering Sex Out Loud listeners a special offer. 10% off and free shipping when you use my code Tristan at uberlube.com. That's 10% off and free shipping. Just use the code Tristan at uberlube.com. Uber Lube lets you feel what you want to feel. You may have noticed the flowers are blooming, the grass is growing, and it's time to mow your lawn. Thanks to our sponsor, Manscaped, you can trim the hedges below the belt safely and efficiently. You know I don't like to beat around the bush, so I won't. Everyone could use a little trim of their pubic hair. Manscaped, the only men's brand dedicated to below-the-waist grooming, is here to make sure your balls, people with balls, are smooth and smelling nice. After all, it's time for some spring and, let's face it, summer cleaning. I actually like to do grooming with a partner. I find it really sexy, but I've used razors before and I'm always afraid to nick their genitals. Scary. You have to use the right tools for the job. When I use the Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0, I know it's safe and it always does a great job. The Perfect Package 3.0 kit comes with the lawnmower, the waterproof cordless body trimmer, anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer, and the Crop Reviver to round out your manscaping routine. This third generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce manscaping accidents. Millions of balls are about to be nick-free thanks to Manscaped advanced skin-safe technology. Subscribe to the Perfect Package and get a new replacement blade refill for your lawnmower trimmer delivered to your door every 3 months. For a limited time, subscribers get two free gifts: the Shed Travel Bag, a $39 value, and the patented high-performance, reduced chafing Manscaped Boxer Briefs. You should really try this out, and I've got a deal for you to get started. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code Tristan at manscaped.com. That's right, go to manscaped.com and get 20% off with free shipping when you use the code Tristan. Your balls will thank you. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking to my guest all the way in the Netherlands, Simone/Simon van Zarloos. And we're going to talk about their book, Playing Monogamy. So one of the things I love about this book, and I talked about it at the top, was that it's not, it's not a sort of like, let me show you all sides of the coin, or, hey, every style of relationships is valid. This is a book against monogamy. And so it references this American book, Laura Kipnis's book, Against Love, in that it has this polemic style, which really works. And I want to dig into kind of some of the themes and things that you write about. First, let's talk about the title and your discussion of monogamy as a performance.
Yeah. So Playing Monogamy, it indeed, of course, refers to the playing, it's the performativity of it. So it talks about, and many people have talked about this, of course, the idea where monogamy is becoming naturalized or neutralized, and it's almost like this is how we live and this is what love means. So I'm also talking about the ways that love and monogamy become synonyms. They're completely equated somehow. I remember, for example, when Obama legalized same-sex marriage in the US, and he said, love is love. And I was really, really puzzled by this sentence, because I was like, what? Love is love. Okay, what does this mean? Okay, so the moment people...
Right, because he didn't legalize love, right? He collapsed the two into one category, because he didn't legalize love.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm trying to think the singer. There's a song that goes like, all love is legal, you cannot legalize it. Okay, yeah. Which is true, I guess, right? Like, so if you think about love, like, how do you legalize love? You can only legalize an institution that then informs what love is. So that is the question that I had. So, okay, what are the ways that love is built in such a way that, or what are the images that make us believe that monogamy equates what love is? And there's so many of those images, but they immediately relate also to consumerism, for example. Like, how do people move in public society? It's almost that, you know, they go to dinner to dinner together. They have a picture taken together, and they look like a couple. So we learn how to recognize couples. So there's, at the one hand, there's this naturalization of what love looks like. And I'm then super interested in, like, what are the other ways that we could imagine love to look like? And also relating it to the playing or the performance, I guess coming from sort of feminist philosophy and this idea of performativity of gender. Performativity or performance does not in any way mean that it's frivolous or that it's easy to play something otherwise, but it does take in account the possibility that there are other forms that we could practice practice and try.
I also think that there's a theme that runs throughout this book about resiliency, the ability to kind of shift and change as needed and not getting invested in anything static or set in stone, and non-monogamy as a kind of container for that practice.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I first published a book in 2015, and then later on only the English translation came out. And I think I changed a little bit on my tone in terms of that, because I think that on one point I thought, oh no, this sounds too much like a neoliberal freelancer who needs to be fluid and flexible and available at all times. And, you know, if you're not able to emotionally shift different precarity situations, then this is your fault. So I figured the tone might be a bit too individual. But what I mean with that, or what I hope I also convey with this resilience, is the question of what does it mean when we say, for example, that monogamy is safe? So I'm talking a lot about these ideas of safety, because I think that the images that that are produced to inform us what love can look like also relate to what we see as safe, like what gives you individually as a psychology or as your psychology a feeling of safety. But there's also a societal aspect of what we consider safe. And I think the way that we are pushed towards monogamy relates to the fact that monogamous behavior is predictable. So we know what couples want. If we tell them what they want, to ensure that it is love. So if we tell couples, oh, I mean, this is very traditional, set, right? But like, if you are in love, you want to get married. If you are in love, you want to hire a photographer and get your picture taken. So there's an economic push towards predictability. We can predict people's behavior because that's what they want to do if they feel like they are in love. But there's also another question where I think it relates also non-monogamous relationships or non-monogamous intimacies are often viewed as unsafe. They're seen as chaotic. They're seen as unsafe. So when there's, for example, childcare involved, then it is often considered there's often a fear for child services to interfere. But there's also the sort of the gaze, and I think it's an institutional gaze that says that if something is illegible, it is not safe. So if it's something that is not being understood, then it is unsafe. So I'm also thinking of the history of how we get to monogamy. So for example, when we look into anthropology and how the anthropology came up, and when there was a Western, Northwestern view studying so-called different cultures, and I'm making like brackets here in the air, there was monogamy was a real measurement of saying, are these people civil monogamous, or when they performed monogamy, something that looked like monogamy enough so that the anthropologist could view it and mark it as monogamy, then people were more civilized than when they were having non-monogamous intimacies or intimacies that could not be traced. And I think here you see already the history of safety. So the moment that you're marked as monogamous, it gives you a legible existence and it makes you part of what is called civilized society. And I think one of the examples I talk about in the preface is Saidiya Hartman's book, Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, where she talks about Black women around the 1900s in North America, in the US, and their wayward intimacies. So whether it's interracial intimacies or intergenerational intimacies, non-monogamous intimacies, these women are all being policed because of that. So marriage is used, for example, they're saying like, oh, are you married? The moment that you're married, it becomes, you're becoming a legible person. If you're not married, then you have a wayward intimacy that is not being understood, and it makes you vulnerable to correction. So the black women that Saidi Hartman is talking about are being put in correctional facilities, are being imprisoned. They're only viewed as promiscuous, criminalized as sex workers. So here we see again how when we're talking about the resilience, this is not an individual quality so much. I think that non-monogamy also practices that in a way, but I think it's also the way that monogamy gives a certain static idea of what safety is, if that makes sense.
And it's a false safety, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the notion that if you're in a non-monogamous relationship, one or more partners might fall in love with someone else. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. But that happens in monogamous relationships all the time. Mm-hmm. So the sense of security is actually a false one. Mm-hmm. If there isn't like a level of communication and awareness and consciousness in like practicing this form of monogamy. One of the things that was most resonant in this book for me is the idea of a much more expansive view of love. Like, why does everything get so focused on romantic and sexual love? And for that matter, there can be romance in non-sexual relationships and in friendships. Mm-hmm. This is a quote from the book. There is no need to reject romance. We just need to share it more widely. The hoarded form of romance that we now see experienced and expressed exclusively between two people needs to go. So I feel like this resonates in my personal life because I feel like I have a lot of different kinds of relationships with a lot of different kinds of people. Mm. And they're deeply close and committed. Some of them are romantic, but they wouldn't fit the definition of quote unquote partner, life partner, spouse, even sometimes lover. There's this quality to my relationships that I feel like people sort of cock their heads. Like, what, I don't understand. What are you to each other? And together, you know, that unknowability that you talk about, yeah. right? I consider one of my closest friends in the world my platonic wife. And we sort of, you know, captured that phrase just to communicate to people that we have a deep commitment and we are a really big part of each other's lives. We don't have a sexual relationship. Maybe we have a little bit of romance, it's not sexual or physical. But even that feels kind of like limiting. Like I use the words that were most available to me, but it still kind of doesn't capture the love that we share because it doesn't fit into these categories, which are so limiting to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a way that refers to relational anarchism, maybe, right? Like this idea of not naming or defining the relationships that you have. And I really like this relational anarchism in the sense that there's not a hierarchizing or a hierarchy of people around you, which I think also relates to this idea that if you think or if you believe or have faith from the perspective of abundance, in the sense that if there is abundant love, and you can fill that in as spiritual or not spiritual as ever you want, but it opposes this idea of scarcity where you have to focus on this one partner and all of your love goes into that. And indeed, like you were saying, the moment that there's somebody else who you fall in love with. It's like the love from one person is drawn away to the other person, where of course from a non-monogamous perspective we know that this is not necessary and not the case. And I think that what one thing that you said also stuck to me, because you said hoarding, which of course has a different feel to it now also with the pandemic and people hoarding toilet paper, for example. But it's this idea of accumulation and having to sit on it, as if it, which also relates of course to an idea of accumulation of wealth and to a certain capitalist, I would say, view on what love is. Like, you're hoarding love and you have to sit on it instead of practice it in order to keep it, where I think it's also possible to stay or be in love, or not hold on to this idea of staying or containing it.
Yeah, and I think that also gets to your point about what it means to actually be consciously in relationship. That's another theme, like, throughout this book, which is that when you have multiple relationships and there isn't one that can be defined externally or even internally as the one, in quotes, then you're constantly being present with the person you're in relationship with, and you're choosing to be there with the awareness that there are other people in your life and there are other people in their lives. And so it's not a sense of kind of, I am obligated to do this. I'm obligated to spend this time with you. But it's that I am choosing to do it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that also relates to what you were saying earlier about romance, right? And like having more romance. Where romance or the romantic gesture evolves around a certain performativity. So it's not, when we talk about romance, it means like an extra layer to reality. So there's an awareness that you're putting in a little bit more effort, which is kind of a vulnerable thing to do, because if I say something romantic now, it's vulnerable because it might just drop the mic and nothing will come after that or something like that. Mm-hmm. Thank you for laughing there. That's important. No, but you know, like, you're looking for an affirmation after a romantic gesture. There's an element of drag there. There's an element of extra there. And I think that the moment that you're not thinking about a love relationship or an intimate relationship as something that needs to be quote unquote real, as something that is either there or not, but something that also comes from performing together, and not defying performance as something unreal or artificial and therefore less valuable, but instead saying that maybe reality is built of many different performances, and depending on the context that you are in, some performances are more pressing than others. So this is, of course, why I referred to gender performativity before, where it's not saying in any way, well, gender does not exist because it's performance. It's saying, no, it actually exists very much, because it is performance, and it's a repeated performance continuously. So I think that it's also this shift of how we look at love and like what we consider love and like what love has to be in order to be called love. I'm also thinking of a part in the book where it's talking about a psychologist who says, well, there's different phases of love. You're going through the phase of dating, etc., and then you start to get to know each other, and this is when the real intimacy rises. I'm sort of paraphrasing him here. The moment that you tell each other those things that you wouldn't tell to other people, which basically is saying, like, okay, there's a sort of transgression, or like these phases that you're going through, which also has this idea of the escalator or the narrative of progress, right? Like, you, and there's also an element of dessert in there. Like, you, if you stick with me long enough, you deserve to get to know this and this, which, right. And there's also this element of idea of secrecy to it. Like, publicly, I'll show you this, but privately, you can know me for real. And this is also why I'm bringing in this idea of the real, like, okay, you and I will have intimacy the moment that you know me for real. But this comes from an idea that there must be something real or natural or deeply carnal or nuclear to know of me. But if I have instead a different form of identity, or like if I look differently at identity, where it's more based on these performativities, and this also has this anticipatory contextual feel to it in relationship to the world that we live in, then you don't say something like, okay, we're only intimate when you know me for real, which then also relates to this idea of knowing for real to, I would perceive, a colonial view of knowing, where demanding to know something or knowing something is somehow better than not knowing. Getting clarity, understanding and defining and naming is somehow better than seeing something as illegible, not understandable, or chaotic even, which is of course a defining already. And so I'm tying this up in the sense that I again think, like, how does our practice and understanding and emotional feeling of what love is, how does it relate to deeper structures of knowledge that inform us how we have to think and how we have to live? And I think that this idea of having to,
And it also reminds me, there's been a lot of talk about the relationship escalator in various polyamorous and non-monogamous work. But you talk about it in a slightly different way, which is, I think, I interpreted it, because the relationship escalator, for people who don't know, is essentially this idea that there's a sort of prescriptive timeline to your relationship. You've been together for a certain amount of time, and now you say, we're going to be exclusive. Then you've been together more time, now we say, I love you. You've been together more time, now we're moving in. You've been together, now we're getting engaged. You've been together, now we're getting married. Now we're having kids. Like that it's, there's a trajectory. And when people interrupt it, you know, like I was just having a conversation with someone. They were talking about this couple who've been together 10 years. And someone on the show was like, well, 10 years and no proposal. What's up with that? Right? And I thought, well, but maybe they are just happy how they are. Like, why does there have to be a looming proposal to sort of validate the relationship? They've been together 10 years. That's a lot. That's a long time. But there's always this kind of looming, like they need to take the next step. They need to, again, sort of achieve these steps that we can identify. And so when people, for example, are married and don't live together, people are like, I don't understand what's going on. You know, or they're married and they're non-monogamous. They're like, no, but why did you get married if you want to be non-monogamous, right? Like the two can't sit kind of alongside each other. And so that's why I like your relationship escalator. It sort of takes it to another level, which is there's also supposed to be an escalation in revelation, in knowing, in feeling, like you feel invested in this person, but then as you get on the escalator, you have to feel like really invested in them and you really know them and they really know you. And that is part of this, the sort of script that we've been given that we're supposed to adhere to. And when we go off book, when we go off in our own direction or on another path, people are constantly like, what are you doing? This doesn't make sense to me. And the me can be a personal feeling for someone, but it's really like, this doesn't make sense to society as we've constructed it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, as you're saying, the revelation. So I relate also the relationship escalator to the stairs, I would say, of Plato. So to this idea again of Western philosophy And again, how are we establishing how we think, how we feel? And this idea of the stairs is, okay, you climb each time a little higher. And Plato is describing this as a sort of like reaching towards a higher consciousness. And not even many people reach the end of the stairs, because that's like the ultimate higher consciousness. So it's this very sort of vertical idea of climbing upwards. Well, of course, this idea of climbing upwards is everywhere in our society, right?
It's upward mobility. It's capitalism.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's that, and it's also relating to our defining of time and how we use time. So like, if you're at the bottom of the stairs, it means that you're backward. If you're up at the stairs, it means that you're into the future. So it's also, the escalator for me is not just sort of the slow progression into, but it's also of the different stages of time and how we view that. And I'm thinking, for example, of a thinker like Denise Ferreira da Silva, who is talking about time in towards a Black feminist poetics. She writes about this idea of linear time, which created not just a difference where, okay, you're at the bottom of the stairs and I'm somewhere at the top of the stairs, but also geographically, whole continents are put back in time. So for example, she's quoting another big philosopher, I don't need to name drop here, but Hegel, let's say it real quick. And she's saying, well, okay, he marked Africa as a continent as being backward, or as being back in time. And then as opposed to that, of course, there's Europe, or there's the US, North America, that are in the present. And that is also the present that everybody wants to reach. So if we think back of this escalator, right, we think back of this dividing of the world into different modes of time. So being backward, being in the present, holding the future. We even see right now, like when people leave their country as refugees because they want to enter Europe, there's this sort of superiority idea that people want to enter Europe because that is where the future is. And there's no questioning of like, okay, maybe this place doesn't hold the future. Maybe keeping people out is not a way to protect the future. Because it's sort of, so I'm just sketching this image as a sort of like how time also becomes a place or a space, and how time in this linear idea of like present, past, and future also has very real consequences. But then relating that back to the idea of non-monogamy, we see similar sort of division where you're at the bottom of the stairs or at the bottom of the escalator when you're just dating, right? We see already this language like, oh, well, how long have you been together? Oh yeah, 2 months. Okay, that's nothing.
right.
And we all want to go towards the end of the stairs, right? Like we all want to reach the end of the escalator. That's at least the idea. Like, and this is also how it's promoted. Like, congratulations, you got married. I mean, it mm-hmm. might seem really nice to say that, but it is completely entangled with this structure.
I can't believe we're out of time, but we are. I want to thank you so much for sending me your book, for writing this book, and for taking the time to have this conversation with me.
Thank you so much for reading and for the work that you do. It reaches beyond the US, much must be clear. Yeah.
I also, I love at the end of the book, you talk about, I don't believe in success, but in trying. And this is a kind of a repetition of, you know, it's not the end point, it's the journey. But it immediately made me think about, oh, this book is against monogamy and it's against success. which is so counter to sort of like neoliberal politics and capitalism. And it also sort of reminds me of The Queer Art of Failure by Jack Halberstam. So I wondered if we could like all spend a day not trying to achieve success, what that might look like. But I want people to read this book. It's called Playing Monogamy. It's published by Publication Studio and available on its website, publicationstudio.biz. You can find Simone Simon at simonevanzarlos.nl and on Twitter and Instagram at svansarlos. And I'm going to spell that SvanSaarLoos. I want to thank everyone out there who's been listening. I want to thank Raymond Johnson, my senior producer, my editor, my engineer, my sanity, my lifeline. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. Until then, you can get the show on Twitter at Sex Out Loud Radio. You can get me across all social media platforms at Tristan Taramino. And go read this book. It's like a tiny gem and it packs a punch. Until next time.